Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Playing God, The Evolution of a Modern Surgeon by Anthony Yoon, M.D., with Alan Eisenstock. Read by Kyle Tate. Prologue. C20, Do 100, Teach 1.
My insides are falling out.
Ruth, 43, sits before me, her hospital gown covering her shockingly bulging belly. The contrast with her thin frame makes it look as if she's got a bowling ball tucked underneath.
These past 3 years have been a nightmare, she says quietly. I was in a car accident. A drunk driver hit me. I was trapped in the car against the steering wheel for over an hour. They had to use the jaws of life to get me out. But then my spleen had burst. The doctors took it out, but then everything got infected. I had 7 surgeries. My stomach is a complete mess. My insides are literally falling out.
She bites her lip and stares past me. I don't just see Ruth's pain. I feel it. It's drawn all over her, from the double crease between her eyebrows to her slumped posture, to the distinct aura of sadness pulsing off her. Dr. Vivek Ramesh, tall, thin, a plastic surgery chief resident, stands next to me, his eyes glued on Ruth. In doctor training terms, Vivek is shadowing me. He shifts his weight, his eyes still fixed on Ruth. I can tell he's waiting for me to say something, since I know he's never seen anything like this before.
What do you mean your insides are falling out? I ask gently. After they removed my spleen, I developed a terrible infection that kept me in the ICU for months, Ruth says. By the time they got rid of the infection, my insides were so swollen they couldn't close up my abdomen. A plastic surgeon put a skin graft over my intestines, but they stick out. You can actually see them.
Tell me, how does this affect your daily life? Her face reddens.
It's humiliating. People stop me and ask, when's the baby due? And when I eat anything, even just a salad, my stomach sticks out even more. I can't go out in public. It's too embarrassing. I just stay home.
Do you have pain?
Constantly. Sometimes I don't think I can take it anymore, but I refuse to take pain pills. I hate how they make me feel.
She lowers her head and studies the floor. Her voice drops to a whisper.
I look deformed. I've always prided myself on staying in shape, eating well. Then this happens. It wasn't even my fault.
She sniffles, swipes at a tear that slowly trickles down her cheek.
And, my husband and me? Well, we can't. You know, I won't let him look at me unless I'm wearing a shirt or something. I don't really let him touch me. I'm afraid he'll feel my abdomen and get disgusted.
Ruth raises her head. Her eyes have filled with tears.
Please, Dr. Yoon, she says. Help me.
I can't imagine, I think. How does this poor woman get through each day? How does she get through her life? I want so much to help her. Please, let me be able to help her. This moment, this patient, this person, Ruth, is the reason I became a doctor. I look into her eyes. Will you show the area to me, Ruth? I say. Ruth nods and lumbers over to the examination table. She pauses, exhales, and tries to hoist herself onto it, cradling her abdomen with one arm and grabbing the edge of the table with the other. She grunts, shakes her head, and looks at me, her eyes pleading. She can't lift herself. Vivek and I move swiftly to either side of her and help her onto the table. Then, settled, Ruth shudders, closes her eyes, and lifts her gown. Her abdomen is littered with scars. In the middle lie her bowels, covered with a nearly opaque layer of skin.
I watch her intestines slowly move, as spontaneous peristalsis occurs in waves, like large snakes slithering under a thin sheet. Vivek's eyes pop open with shock. I palpate Ruth's abdomen, trying to determine how much skin and muscle I may be able to mobilize to cover her exposed intestines. I sit before her for several seconds, staring at her abdomen, envisioning each step of the complicated surgery necessary to fix her. Suddenly, a comforting and familiar feeling sweeps through me. I feel a kind of calm. I know what to do. I then speak my favorite sentence in the English language. I can help you. Ruth reaches over and grabs my hand.
Are you sure?
I look into her eyes and smile confidently, reassuringly. Yes, I say. In the field of medicine, we have a saying, see one, do one, teach one. I don't agree with this. If physicians took this literally, we'd kill half our patients. I believe the saying should be, see 20, do 100, teach one. The surgery we'll be performing on Ruth, Vivek assisting, presents many similarities to a tummy tuck. Since Vivek has performed dozens of those, I decide to let him start. Scalpel, please, I say to the scrub technician, Christina. She places the scalpel in my hand. I turn it around, handle toward Vivek. Okay, Vivek, make the incision. He takes the knife, hesitates, and begins to cut along the line I drew on Ruth's abdomen. He incises through her skin with expert precision. Bovi cautery, please, I say to Christina. She hands me the cautery device. I place it in Vivek's hand. Dissect down toward the fascia. He presses a button, and the metal tip of the Bovi effortlessly glides through Ruth's underlying fat, bloodlessly splaying it open. My eyes narrow. Something doesn't look right. Stop, I say. I move Vivek's hand away. The Bovi turns off. Do you see that? I ask him.
What do you mean?
Vivek's eyes, the only part of his face I can see above his mask, lock onto mine. Vivek, I say, don't you see that loop of intestine? His pupils practically dilate. Sweat beads on his brow.
My God, I was 2 seconds away from cutting right into it.
A single loop of small intestine, the width of a pinky finger, lies scarred and adhered to the overlying skin. In a normal person, this intestine would lie in a completely different position. But Ruth isn't normal. Her previous surgeries and infections have caused her insides to no longer conform to any anatomy textbook. Cutting open her intestine in a non-intestinal operation would be a total disaster. Ruth would have come in for a tummy tuck and left with a colostomy bag. Or, worst-case scenario, in a body bag. I gently place my gloved hand on Vivek's. It's all right. I take over for Vivek, who stands to the side, immobile as a statue, except for his hands, which begin to tremble. I complete the rest of the surgery. It takes 3 hours. I keep Ruth's intestines intact and put them inside her, where they belong, and I flatten her stomach. After I insert the last stitch, Vivek and I take off our gowns and gloves. You okay, Vivek? I say.
I think so.
He slowly shakes his head.
I'm still reeling from almost botching the whole operation.
You didn't botch it. It was a learning experience. I promise you, remembering this case will make you a better surgeon.
I guess you learn more from your mistakes than from your successes.
Absolutely. Especially in surgery. I touch Vivek's arm. You're going to be okay. I want to encourage him. No, I need to encourage him. Suddenly, I see myself as Vivek, a young, inexperienced, unsure resident. I remember how much I needed encouragement, especially after I'd made a mistake, when I felt I was flailing. As if he's reading my mind, Vivek says,
Dr. Yoon, Did you ever doubt yourself? Did you wonder if you'd ever become as good as the doctors who trained you?
I grin at Vivek. When I was a resident, I was the king of self-doubt. Even after residency. Man, do I have stories. Doctors don't become good surgeons overnight. The ability to remove a tumor, fix a heart, or reconstruct a breast doesn't happen over a span of hours, or days, or weeks, or even months. Neither does the ability to gain the trust of frightened patients and give them hope. But with enough persistence and compassion, even doctors in training who initially lack confidence and skill can become excellent surgeons. When I graduated from medical school, I didn't have a clue what it meant to be a real doctor. I knew what I'd learned from textbooks, but textbook knowledge means little in an actual hospital. It took me the entire 6 years after medical school, working and training as a resident, taking care of the sick, the injured, and even the hopeless, to become a qualified doctor and a competent surgeon. My journey didn't end there. My education continued into the early stages of practice. In fact, it was during those years, after I became a legitimate board-certified plastic and reconstructive surgeon, that I questioned myself the most. They say a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. In medicine, it can be a deadly thing. I often worried that I wasn't good enough. I was terrified that I would be the anti-Hippocrates, that I would first do harm. I sent many desperate pleas to God to intervene in my patient's well-being. Thankfully, those moments were tempered and balanced by times that I made my patients' lives healthier. Not just healthier, but happier. Better. My personal journey of self-doubt, questioning, and learning reflects a path that most surgeons, most doctors, experience, each in their own way. While the following is my personal story, aspects of it apply to all surgeons, even all doctors. Hopefully, for every physician, these successes and failures will culminate in one common result: becoming a good doctor. Several months later, I'm vacationing with my wife and kids on the west coast of Michigan at Grand Haven, my old stomping grounds. It's a sunny day with a low breeze. The muggy 90-degree Michigan heat simmers, while a beach band plays in the distance. The sounds of seagulls squawking as they search for food, and kids laughing and shouting as they frolic in the water, bring me back to my days as a resident physician. Dozens of evenings, I moonlighted as a musician in this town, playing guitar and singing Margaritaville and tiki bars. Then, exhausted yet exhilarated, I'd head back to Grand Rapids, put on my doctor costume and my serious surgeon face, and pray that I knew what I was doing at the hospital the next morning, or at least that I could fake it until I figured it out. This day, as I sit on the beach, the faces of patients and their families fill my memory. I see faces that plead for help, long for comfort, cry with grief, and smile with gratitude. These are the faces of the patients who allowed me to be their doctor, their surgeon. These are the faces to whom I owe my career. The images shimmy, blur, and blend away. I turn and focus on a mom in a one-piece bathing suit, playing with her children near the water. There's something familiar about her. I watch her run through the waves, chasing three little boys, none older than 5 or 6 years. Laughing and splashing, they fall into the shallow tide together. Then I realize why she looks familiar. The woman is Ruth. I watch her enjoying this beautiful day with her kids. I spot her husband sitting on a blanket several yards away, grinning at his lovely wife and beautiful children. Ruth glances my way. She does a double take, and then she stares at me. A moment later, she waves. I wave back. She points to her kids, her husband, and her stomach. And then she smiles. All the doubts, insecurities, and nearly ruptured intestines fade away. In that moment, I know it is all worthwhile. I smile back. Part 1. Internship. 1. Putting out fires. I am a doctor.
Every time I say that to myself, an aftershock of happiness ripples through me, 10.0 on the Richter scale. Even though at times it seemed like this moment would never come to pass, I have finally, blessedly put medical school in my rearview mirror.
I have triumphed.
I have slayed the dragon of sleepless nights, endless exams, cadaver dissections, practice physical exams, bossy physicians and nurses, and several oceans of paperwork.
I am a doctor.
Starting tomorrow, July 1st, I will be a first-year resident, commonly known as an intern. I have been blessed with the perfect girlfriend, Amy, who's finishing medical school here in Grand Rapids. She has 1 year left to go before beginning a pediatrics residency. We're going strong. That is, in the 10 to 15 minute increments we get to spend with each other when we're actually awake. She's so busy and exhausted that when we catch a rare evening together, we order in food and rent a movie. 12 minutes into the movie, like clockwork, she's out cold, and I get to watch her sleep. Which is great. She's so beautiful when she sleeps, mouth slightly open, purring like a kitten. So cute. There she is, passed out, cuddled into me, her brown hair brushing my cheek. I get to spend the next 2 hours trying to get the feeling back in my arm and shoulder. And now that I'm a doctor, I have done what every doctor dreams of doing once they're finally done climbing out of Dante's circles of hell, commonly known as medical school. I bought a hot new car. Well, okay, a hot used car. But to me it's new, and totally hot. A snazzy Toyota RAV4, to replace my ancient, rusted-out, held-together-by-chewing-gum-and-baling-wire Ford Tempo. That infuriating 24/7 pinging noise that drowned out the radio and ground away on the last good nerve I had turned out to be a death rattle. The Ford Tempo bit the dust, bought the farm, and moved on to that great auto showroom in the sky. I slide behind the wheel of my RAV4, confident that I can finally attain a speed of over 35 on the freeway without my molars coming loose. Most important, though, I've earned the respect of my old country Korean parents, especially my dad, a doctor himself. A man of few words, he was moved to deliver the following stirring words of encouragement while slurping my mother's squid soup and chewing a spoonful of tentacles.
Tony, okay. You be plastic surgeon, okay. Not as good as transplant surgeon, or neurosurgeon, or trauma surgeon. Why you not be transplant surgeon? Good money. Best money. But at least plastic surgeon much better than pediatrician. Or, God forbid, family doctor. Make lots more money. But be careful. Be like daddy. 30 years OBGYN, daddy never gets sued. Never. Not once. Don't get sued. Good soup.
Smile. Slurp. Swallow. Of course, to be fair, on the downside, I owe $125,000 in loans. Let me repeat that. $125,000. And I'm about to go further into debt. I will pay all that off once I complete the next leg of my journey, which starts tomorrow. A 5-year residency. 3 years of general surgery, followed by 2 years of plastic surgery. On top of 20 years of school already, that means by the time I'm done, I will have spent 80% of my life in school. No worries. Par for the course. That's how we doctors roll. Speaking of worries, while I've been accepted into Michigan State's program in Grand Rapids, I admit, okay, I'm having massive opening day jitters. Because when my brain asks me, what could go wrong? I have to answer, everything. Look, when you're a professional baseball player and you strike out with the bases loaded in the bottom of the ninth, your team loses. When you strike out as a doctor, people go brain dead, their organs fail, and yes, sometimes they die. I have to swat those away, and I will, because I am a doctor. Right? Like gunslingers emerging from a mist, we stride together in slow motion, the five of us, flanked side by side. Ready to do battle with everything from necrotic gallbladders to perforated intestines to punctured lungs. Nurses and administrative staff retreat, allowing us to pass. We take up the entire hallway. We bash through the saloon doors at the end of the corridor. We wear white. Our starched, unblemished, long white coats glide across the linoleum. Our heads are held high. Our eyes are unblinking, intelligent, focused, fearless, the color of cement. We are first-year residents. We are the law. We are lost. Totally, completely, stupidly lost. At least, that's how I feel, though I would never say it to anyone. The gunslinger image lasts maybe 5 seconds before real time, real life, sets in. We are in fact five interns breaking for lunch after a 2-hour orientation session where we learned the basics of CPR, practicing first aid on EMT dummies, and then for some of us, on real live dummies, each other. I came this close to giving mouth-to-mouth to a nerdy, bespectacled, musky-smelling guy named Conrad, until someone stepped in and saved my bacon. We have officially been practicing doctors for all of 3 hours. Even after orientation activities, we remain an improv troupe, ready to wing it in medical emergencies, clueless in the heat of the moment, as everyone yells out suggestions of what to inject, cut off, or cut into. We are sometimes all that stands between a patient slipping from the hospital ward down into the basement morgue, which is just as horrifying as it sounds. But you probably couldn't tell from just looking at us. We give the illusion of being actual, real, seasoned, competent doctors. Operative word being illusion. There are no doctor-in-training signs on our backs, like those signs you see in cars where terrified teenagers are trying to learn to drive. You know, the ones you steer as far away from as possible. We enter the cafeteria, the smell of boiled cabbage laced with disinfectant causing a momentary gag reflex. We slither single file into the food line and watch happy people in hairnets ladle thick, steaming, brown, murky, blobby globs into bowls and, snickering, hand them to us. We sidestep to the end, gather forks, spoons, napkins, and commandeer a sticky table in the far corner. We smell, taste, and chew tentatively. Finally, Jessica, short, thin, and Asian, speaks for all of us. Yum. Shelley sits across from me, husky voice and vampira looks. She's a gunner I know from medical school, so-called because of her frenetic pace and kill-at-all-costs-and-leave-no-survivors worldview, driving full speed ahead toward becoming a trauma surgeon. She pushes her bowl away like it's radioactive, which it might well be, and says, "I was reading the general surgery residency manual last night." "Wait," Jessica stares at her. "You were reading what?" "She reads manuals like that for fun," I say. "Insurance policies, warranties. Turns her on. To her, they're like porn." I slurp the stew, or the liquid mulch, or whatever the hell it is. It's not terrible. Hell, I lived on $5 pizzas and Burger King for 4 years in medical school. "Enjoy your light reading," Jessica sniffs. "I'm more hands-on. Like to roll up my sleeves. Get dirty." "I hear ya," Conrad says, his eyes half closed. "I love the smell of human flesh getting cauterized." "I know. There's nothing like the smell of napalm in the morning, right?" Jessica says. "Exactly," Conrad says, eyes still glazed. "You're serious," Jessica says. After a pause, she turns to me. "He's serious." Conrad shrugs. "I like the smell of burning flesh. Something about it relaxes me." "We have a winner," Jessica says. "Where's Garth?" Gunner Shelley says, scanning the cafeteria. "He was right behind us in line, and then he disappeared."
"He does that," Conrad says.
On cue,
Garth Ellington's laugh, a deep, booming roar, cuts through the ambient murmuring in the cafeteria. Then Garth appears at the edge of our table with the general surgery chief resident, Dr. Weinberger, a tall, balding Macher at the hospital. He throws his head back in what seems to me an over-the-top theatrical laugh, then leans a hand on Dr. Weinberger's shoulder.
"I never heard that one," Garth says, and repeats the punchline. "Either way, you're screwed."
The two of them laugh again.
"Don't forget,"
Dr. Weinberger says, with a grin like Heath Ledger's Joker.
"We tee off tomorrow morning, 7:30 sharp.
"Put my clubs in the car this morning," Garth says.
Then looking at me, Dr. Weinberger says,
"Because if you're on call, Garth, I'm sure I can convince somebody to switch with you."
"No, no, I'm fine. I wouldn't want to inconvenience anyone."
"Okay, then.
And oh, Saturday? It's 3 for cocktails."
"I'm looking forward to that. I haven't done much sailing."
"You'll take to it, I can tell. Like a fish to water."
Garth and Dr. Weinberger howl like a couple of wasted frat boys.
"What the hell?"
Jessica says to me, low. More laughing, slapping of backs. Dr. Weinberger makes a pistol with his thumb and index finger and shoots Garth. He gives a dismissive sneer toward the rest of us.
"Scut monkeys, all,"
his dark expression says, and bounds off toward the swinging doors leading out of the cafeteria.
"Sorry, guys," Garth says, vaulting onto a chair at the head of the table.
He lowers his head and actually blushes.
"He cornered me."
"Golf? Cocktails? Sailing? Maybe it's me." I pretend to sniff my underarms.
"No, I'm good."
"So, Garth, what was that?" Garth shrugs as he extracts a power bar from his shirt pocket, unwrapping and nibbling with small, dainty bites.
"I don't know. Whiny has been very nice to me."
"Whiny?" all of us spout in chorus. Garth lowers his head, reddens, and chuckles. I'd known about and competed against Garth Ellington since I listed Grand Rapids as my first choice for residency a few months earlier. Dr. Carr, a dean at the medical school, warned me that while I was a good candidate, he considered me a long shot to get in. Grand Rapids had exactly 2 open spots in plastic surgery, and they'd already committed 1 to Garth. Not that Garth was ever an actual, active rival. He just happened to be kind of in my way. And I kind of got it. He overshadowed me. To be honest, he overshadowed everybody, the way James Bond overshadows all other mortals. Garth was older, established, and not a punk like the rest of us. He was 33, married, father of 2 adorable, precocious kids, a black belt in kung fu, a gourmet cook, an amateur sculptor, a scratch golfer, a young Patrick Dempsey lookalike, a gifted doctor with maestro's hands. And worst of all, he appeared to be genuinely modest, polite, generous, and kind. He entered elevators last, asked everyone their floor, and operated all the buttons like a doorman. He helped elderly people cross the street. He handed out $5 bills to the homeless. He shoveled his neighbors' sidewalks and driveways in winter and mowed their lawns in summer. If he washed his car, he washed yours, too. And in his spare time, I'm pretty sure he saved orphans and puppies. You could easily hate him. I don't. I like him. I enjoy his company. And even though I shouldn't, I envy his luck. Hell, I want to be him when I grow up.
"You know, Garth," Gunnar Shelley says, pursing her lips, crossing her legs and swinging them slowly back and forth,
twirling a few strands of hair between 2 fingers flashing blood-red nail polish.
"I was studying the general surgery residency manual last night in bed."
"Me too,"
Garth says, perking up, carefully sweeping a few straggling crumbs of power bar into his palm.
"Wealth of information in there, and surprisingly well-written."
"Shoot me,"
Jessica says, eyes rolling. Garth's cell phone rings, his ringtone the jarring, overloud, tinkling chorus to "I Just Can't Wait to Be King" from The Lion King. Another Garth shrug.
"My kids picked it," he whispers apologetically.
then changes his tone into a melodious sing-song baritone and croons into the phone,
"Sample complete. Ready to continue?"